This is KCBX HD1 San Luis Obispo, KNBX HD1 San Ardo, and KSBX Santa Barbara, streaming online at kcbx.org. The following program represents the views of the speakers and not necessarily those of KCBX. KCBX welcomes the comments of those with divergent views. Our phone number is 805-781-3875. Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, grandmother, licensed marriage therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all these skills to address the subjects that we all grapple with in this conversation with a reluctant therapist. Happy Tuesday, Elizabeth. What's on your mind today?
Happy Tuesday, Tyler. You also missed mother. I skipped from wife to grandmother.
Oh, my goodness.
I don't want to overlook my girls.
sorry. Still getting the things here at KCBX. Getting the hang of things here at KCBX.
It's happy to have you here. Welcome. What's on my mind today? Let me see. First I need to turn my phone off. There you go. I have my daughter Kelly home for spring break this week, and she had her wisdom teeth pulled this morning, so I'm a little bit preoccupied about that.
Oh my gosh.
Last year when she was home for spring break, we had her tonsils taken out. And then I don't know if you remember, but last month she had an emergency appendectomy. I talked about that on the air. So my poor Kelly now has had everything removed that can be removed. And I'm hoping that this spring break is the last time she comes home and has some sort of medical experience.
My parents did the same to me, but it was always Christmas break. So I had my tonsils out over Christmas break, my wisdom teeth out over Christmas break, just really ruining several Christmas breaks.
We're not doing this to you. I want this to be stated, not a to you sort of thing. It is a developmental thing. But yeah, that's kind of on my mind today. I'm thinking about her and hoping that she heals quickly and well and is able to get back to school fairly pain-free. I'm thinking about the phenomenal March for Our Lives this past weekend, all over the country. Once again, you know, young people, older people, all sorts of people taking to the streets to have their voices be heard. And, you know, there is no cynic in me in any of this. And it bothers me that there's a lot of cynicism about the children, you know, taking to the streets and some people saying, well, they don't have a vote. They shouldn't have a voice, or, you know, and a lot of people kind of lifting up saying, well, now it's their turn and, you know, the children will lead the way. And both of those are too far in the opposite end of the spectrum. The children aren't going to be solely responsible for changing the way of the world moving forward unless they all run for office, because right, ultimately the change is going to have to come through legislative action, forcing the legislative action that can be the momentous force of all the children taking to the streets that help add to this push towards change. And then the other far end view is that kids shouldn't have the voice, or that what do they know because they're, you know, 15 16 17, mm-hmm. 18, whatever the age is. But if you look developmentally at children, by the time they reach the age of 12, one of the things that's kind of slips into our consciousness at the age of 12 is what we consider the BS meter, where children are able to sense on a really strong scale or sense, a deep sense, when they're being lied to. Mm-hmm. And because also from 12 to 17, they have a very strong sense of the world in terms of black and white. We teach them right from wrong, and there isn't a lot of swimming in the gray area. They start to understand the gray area more and more as they progress. And of course, when you move out into the adult world, that gray area gets murky and kind of dark, and then you become jaded and cynical. But there's this beautiful time period in a young person's development from 12 to about 18 where they have a strong sense of right and wrong. They see it. They do not like injustice. They feel confident in speaking out. They are coming into this awareness that they didn't have from 0 to 12, where you're kind of in this childhood bubble. But there's this amazing awakening that happens. And that's why the teen years are so full of conflict.
Well, compounded with the fact that these are such high drama years, I'm assuming, right? Everything is just to the max during this time.
That's right. The whole definition of adolescence is little deaths. It's a letting go of childhood and moving into adulthood. And it's all those years between that are kind of this dissonance-filled experience. But to the positive, when the fog lifts at 12 and children are able to start seeing the BS and they start questioning what's going on around them, this is the perfect time to take that energy and start doing something with this strong sense of justice or need for justice. It's the reason that we can send young people off to war at 18, because they're still filled with this sense of idealism and hope and understanding that there is a right and a wrong. They haven't been jaded. So that's why it's, you know, we can send people out and they're full of testosterone and energy. But the idea that the children don't have a clear understanding of what's happening, they might not understand the nuances of PACs and lobbyists and the dirty politics, but they certainly can see the simple truth that from 1999 to now, we've had 10 school shootings per year. We've had over 187,000 children attending at least 193 different schools experiencing some sort of school shooting on their campus since 1999. Those are facts of these children's lives. If they're 18 years old, since they were 8 years old, there have been 10 shootings a year. That's an easy thing for them to wrap their head around, mm-hmm. that this can no longer go on. So that's on my mind. How do we take this energy? How do we help develop the understanding that these children have about justice and injustice and help them not get jaded, help them not to lose that sense of idealism that things can be different and to keep moving forward. And you know, this isn't the first generation of children that have taken to the streets either.
Right.
You know, in 1963, in May of 1963, we had the Birmingham March, Children's March, the Birmingham Children's Crusade. And it started by a young African-American man, 18 years old, decided that he was going to walk to Birmingham to protest the lack of civil rights. And so he initiated this walk. 800 fellow students joined him, this march. They got to Birmingham, and by the time they got there, children poured into the streets. There were 3,000 children that participated in these marches. And on the second day of the marches, that's when, and I'm sure if you're a history person at all, you'll remember that that's when the commissioner, Bull Connor, so the name is perfect for what happened. He actually turned fire hoses and attack dogs on the children and to disperse the marches. And this brought the civil rights movement to the forefront. So the act of these children was one of the cornerstones of change.
Yeah.
So that's one end of my thought process today. And there's a lot of conversation to be had about what will happen after the marches. Will the marches continue? Will these young people keep their energy up? And you were in Santa Maria, right, this weekend?
I was in Santa Maria. And, you know, one of the big things that they were doing to sort of the next step as far as change is this march that was happening in Santa Maria as part of the March for Our Lives, but also protesting a gun store across the street. But these activists were there actively getting, you know, these children or students who were 18 to register to vote, because that is the next obvious step for these people. You know, we've got primaries coming up, we've got midterms coming up, and so change for these kids, they're sort of thinking about, they started this national conversation, the best thing that they can do is start voting.
Well, and it's interesting because you and I didn't even confer on this, but that was the second prong of my show today, which is fine. We can jump to it. And my friends and I have been talking about it a lot. We should consider these young people. I'm not going to say these young people because I don't want to be that grandparent who says those young kids will take care of it. We really should consider changing the voting law to 16.
Mm-hmm.
And to empower young people to take an active role in our government and in society and in the culture, because when they're 16, they're still in school. We have an opportunity to teach government and civics, which I had growing up. I don't know, you're younger than me, so I don't know if it was still mandatory when you were young, but we were taught how to read a ballot, how to vote, how to understand the initiatives. Like, that was an actual part of my education in high school.
I went to a private school and I didn't get that at all. We had government, but no, we didn't. I didn't have any of that at all.
Right, and we were also taught to drive a car. We had driver's training in school. You know, there's been a shift in education between my generation and your generation, and the shift was from this idea that we were educating the whole citizen. The idea of public education was to educate the whole citizen, not just in the ABCs, right, reading, writing, arithmetic, or to prep them for jobs, but it was also to help them be prepared for family life, to be prepared for balancing a checkbook or the finances, the economics of a home. Home economics was about preparing for raising a family. And then there was a whole part of the education about being a citizen of this country and what were those roles and responsibilities. Because remember, public education, the whole idea originally behind it, one part being we needed an educated workforce to work for the industrialized, you know, nation we were becoming. But it was also because we were a country of immigrants and people were coming in with so many different backgrounds and religions and beliefs that they needed some way of educating all of these young people into one common understanding of what it was to be a citizen and what that responsibility was. And part of it was, how do we vote? How do we create an educated electorate moving forward? And so I would love to have part of the conversation today be about people's thoughts about reducing the voting age to 16 and what that would entail. You know, registering the kids to vote is one thing. It's wonderful. Get them prepared for 18. But if we have an opportunity to help them understand the voting process before they leave high school, we're going to have a much more educated electorate moving forward, because otherwise, where do you learn those skills? It's like every important thing that we do as an adult, from marriage to child rearing to driving a car to managing a home, voting has consequences that will impact our lives forever, and it should be treated as a necessary fundamental skill in adulthood. So that's part of my thrust for today, is that conversation. And then the other piece is about the mental health part, because there's a lot of conversation about the march and the children and people coming forward saying we need to do something about gun legislation. But also part of this conversation that's always thrown in there is this idea of mental health, and that we need more mental health services, and that we need to, you know, better the mental health opportunities for people that are struggling. But I never hear anything that sounds remotely feasible in any sort of concrete way that really would make a difference. And so I want to propose, along with my six-year-old voting, an idea that I've had for a while and have talked to school administrators about trying to initiate in our schools. And it emerged from this course that I took based on a study that was done. It's called the School Safe Initiative, and it was done by the U.S. Secret Service and the Department of Education. And this study was done for the prevention of school attacks in the United States. And the study was done after Columbine in 1999, and it looked at attacks on schools from 1974 to 2000. And they were making an attempt to figure out if there was any knowable information that could prevent other targeted school attacks. So since this study was done in 1999, as I mentioned earlier, there have been 10 school shootings per year. I don't see any of the recommendations from the School Safe Initiative having been implemented in a large way. So I want to talk about the School Safe Initiative and what the Secret Service and the Department of Education found, and if we could somehow incorporate that into our education system moving forward, so that we can not only make schools safer, but ultimately to try to intervene for the people that become active shooters, for Nicholas Cruz and other young people who have felt so desperate or alienated or isolated or lost that they felt their only way moving forward was to attack a school. There are many intervention possibilities for these all men from the survey that was done, looking at all young men who found themselves in a place where they were planning these targeted attacks. What are the things we could have done through our school system to change the course of their lives? So that's where I'm at today. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. You can be part of the conversation by giving us a call at 805-781-3875. You can also find me on my Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist. Send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org under the News Talk tab, or podcast our show through Apple Podcasts or any way that you get your podcasts. A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Hit subscribe and the show will be uploaded. And Tyler's great about getting the shows up really quickly, so they'll be there for you and ready to listen.
All the world and the mess that we're making, can't give up and hope, God will intercede. Come on back, imagine that we could get it together and stand up for where we need to be. 'Cause crying won't save or feed a hungry child. Can't lay down and wait for a miracle to change things. So lift up your eyes, lift up your heart, singing, mercy, will we overcome this? Oh, one by one, could we turn it around? Maybe carry on just a little bit longer. And I try to give you what you need.
You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I need to take a breath. I need to catch my breath. So, as part of the ongoing training to maintain my license, every 2 years I have to go through a series of continuing education units. And this year, one of the programs that I came across was the School Safe Initiative. It was a study that was done by the U.S. Secret Service and the Department of Education after Columbine in 1999. And they looked at 37 different incidents committed by 41 individuals over a 25-year period. And they were looking at the profiles of these young men that planned these targeted attacks on schools, trying to find some knowable information, some sort of profile that would help them to prevent these attacks going forward. So I'm going to list for you some of the key findings that they came up with and what the plan was to be moving forward. So some of the things that they found were there were 10 key issues that were similar in the 41 individuals who did these attacks. When these attacks were rarely sudden or impulsive, they were planned. Prior to the attacks, others knew of the idea or plan of to pull off these attacks. Most of the people who committed the attacks did not threaten targets directly prior to the attack. There was no accurate profile that they could create, identifying who a potential attacker would be. Most attackers, though, did display some sort of disturbing behaviors prior to the attacks that caused others in their lives to be concerned. And then here's where things, to me, start to get key to the mental health component. Most, if not all, of the attackers had some sort of difficulty coping with a failure or significant loss in their life prior to the attack, and many had considered or attempted suicide prior to the attack. Most had felt bullied or persecuted. Most attackers had access to or used weapons prior to the attack. Wasn't their first time using weapons. In most cases, other students were involved in the attack in some capacity. And despite prompt law enforcement response, most shooting incidents were stopped by other means, not by law enforcement or someone carrying a gun at the scene. Most of the attackers had a grievance against at least one of the targets at the school. and half the targets were school administrators, teachers, or a staff member. But because they weren't able to come up with an accurate profile, there were some generalities they were able to recognize. That the median age of the attackers was 13 to 18 years old. And we talk about that tumultuous adolescent years of, you know, kind of living through a lot of change and confusion and overwhelm. Two-thirds of the attackers came from two-parent families. Three-quarters of them were white. Only 5% of the attackers lived with foster parents or legal guardians. 41% of the attackers were actually doing fairly well in school. They were A and B students. Only 5% were failing out of school at the time. They had a wide variety of social relationships on the school campuses that they went to, from being completely socially isolated to actually being fairly popular. 41% of the attackers were considered mainstream. 27% were kind of the fringe friend group. 12% of them had no close friends. And a third of them were loners. 44% of them were actually involved in organized activities outside of schools. They did sports. They're part of a religious community or clubs. 63% never were rarely in trouble at school. Only 10% had been expelled at some time. So you can see there's like the things that we assume are going to be the problems weren't the problems. But when you get down to the kind of nitty-gritty, if there is anything that connects them all, 98% of the attackers were having difficulty coping with losses, personal failures, or other difficult circumstances prior to the attack. They had either experienced or perceived some major loss prior to the attack, including a perceived loss of status, maybe, you know, in their being alienated from their friendship group or being ostracized from something they cared deeply about, the loss of a loved one, or a significant love relationship, including a romantic relationship. You know, young people feel things at very heightened levels, especially through their teens, and the loss of a romantic relationship can feel like the end of the world. And again, 98% of the attackers were experiencing some level of loss, whether it was from perceived loss of status, loss of a loved one, the death of a loved one, or the loss of a significant relationship, or they might have experienced a major illness, or someone close to them might have experienced a major illness. 83% of them displayed behavior suggesting they were having trouble coping with these losses prior to the attack. So I want to focus on that piece, because if we understood how to intervene well after trauma, after loss, during grief, I'm not saying we would prevent all school shootings at all times, but I feel like we would have a better chance of preventing more violence moving forward. And then the other piece of the dealing with the trauma and loss and grief for these young men who became school attackers, whether it's through guns or knives or other forms, If there were 187,000 children who were exposed to gun violence since Columbine by being on a campus that had a shooting, they now are in that category of being traumatized and dealing with grief and loss. And so my hope is that the schools will focus more energy on helping personnel on campus become adept at identifying and helping students deal with grief and loss and trauma, and spend less time and money and efforts into kind of these one-day programs like anti-bullying campaigns that all look great on paper because that becomes the thrust of attention. But if instead of spending $15,000 to bring in an anti-bullying speaker or another special group that's on the road selling their program, why not put that $15,000 into empowering the janitor or the lunch lady or the school secretary or nurse to be able to notice and recognize and talk to and reach out to these students? Because ultimately, the findings of the School Safe Initiative were, if there was a key individual on campus that would connect with young people, adults who were charged with meeting students, opportunity, you know, helping them with their emotional and their safety needs, students ultimately just need one adult that they can turn to make all the difference in them coping with loss and trauma and grief. One adult. And they cited in this study that it could be anyone from the bus driver to the custodian to a coach to a dean to a secretary to a teacher to a nurse. One of these people being trained to understand and recognize when a student is struggling, to be able to talk to them and have a conversation. We're not talking about rocket science when it comes to helping people. Although I love my profession and I'm very proud of talk therapy as a skill and a profession, the skills of listening to another individual, of witnessing their pain or being able to connect with someone who's struggling, that's a human skill. That's not a specialized skill that you need to go get a master's degree or a doctorate degree to do. Any human being with any level of empathy can be taught the proper helping skills of listening and supporting and responding. And we're not talking about needing to zoom in and medicate all of these children because they're struggling or feeling traumatized. We're not talking about zooming in and pulling them out of school and putting them into special programs. Because believe me, for many students, it's more traumatic to be pulled out of their school and pulled in a special program than it is to be struggling at school. Instead of making these children feel more isolated and more separate from their school environment, why aren't we rushing in to kind of support and normalize what they're experiencing? It's normal for teenagers to feel anxious and overwhelmed. It's normal for people going through grief and trauma to feel angry, to feel depressed, to feel lost. So that's my first proposal. What do you think about that? You know, let's take these $15,000 endowments and put that money into teaching the basic helping skills to the entire campus. Because think about it, after all this money, Tyler, that went into this report done by the Secret Service and the Department of Education, it came down to one thing at the end. They couldn't choose one profile that would fit all attackers. So they weren't able to say, here's what we look for, and we'll build a red flag and yank them out of school. They weren't able to come up with one way of, you know, measuring how to protect the schools best, because the attackers weren't stopped with people by guns who had guns. Mm-hmm. The only thing they could find was that 98% of these attackers were struggling prior to the event, that other people knew they were struggling, and that if one adult had been able to recognize and step forward and connect with them, it could have made all the difference.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it goes back to what you and I were talking about before, just before the program started. It was just like, it's how we treat mental health in this country, you know, just the way that we need to reassess all of this and take it in. And that, you know, that's a lot of the reporting that we're going to be doing here at KCPX moving forward, is looking at how we treat this. And, you know, especially here in Slo County, it can be a really big issue.
Well, and it's a countrywide issue because mental health is a loaded word that gets thrown out there. You know, when we say, oh, the shooter was mentally ill, it somehow separates them from the mainstream. Mm-hmm. Like, well, they were mentally ill, so clearly this couldn't happen to anyone else. And as long as we continue to push people over into corners as, well, they're mentally ill, we need to push them aside, we are absolutely missing the point, which is any one of us, anyone at any time, given enough trauma or grief or overwhelm or desperation, can become mentally ill. You know, mental illness isn't diabetes. It's not cancer. Mental illness is triggered by an event. 98% of mental illness is triggered by some traumatic event. You can go back in someone's history and you can see those places where things happen. And again, I don't want to glamorize or take Nicholas Cruz, the shooter from Marjorie Stoneman, off the hook in any way. But he is a 19-year-old. From a neuroscience perspective, he was still a child at 19, because neuroscience says that we are not fully adults until the age of 25. And if we are going to hook our star to neuroscience and brain science and say, okay, 25 is the adulthood, this young man was still not fully an adult. He had lost his mother a few months before this. He had been adopted as a baby and lost his adoptive father when he was 2. He had been identified as being developmentally delayed. There were so many traumas in this young man's life. And if you look at the red flag history of it, he was put in special schools, then taken out of the special school, then put in the mainstream. He had behavior issues and disciplinary issues. He was treated like a criminal in the making all the way through. But if you read his history, the only mental health services I could see, and I'm not his doctor, but in the article I read in the Washington Post, is that the medical treatment he got was psychiatric help, which that's code for medication. Mm-hmm. But there was no place in there where someone recognized this kid was traumatized by loss. He was, you know, abandoned, adopted, father dies, mother dies, and we're surprised something happens. All right. So I've had my say. These are my two things. You know, what do we do in the schools? Is anyone with me here that we take all of this money, not all of this money, because there's not a lot of money in schools everywhere, but let's start using mental health funding in ways that are really productive, which is teaching these basic helping skills. I'll teach these basic helping skills to any school that needs it, because these listening skills, as I said, are not magic and they are not rocket science. They are human skills. But if we could help adults feel empowered to connect with students and not vilify students or see them as disciplinary problems, that'll make a difference. And then what do you think of this idea of changing the voting age to 16 and teaching civics in school and helping young people develop a full sense of citizenship by the time they graduate from high school so they feel empowered and they feel vested in the community? I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Our number is 805-781-3875. We'll be back to take your calls.
You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials, because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nub.
You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And here are the questions posed today. Should we lower the voting age to 16? What do you think about that? Should we be developing our full citizenship before students leave high school and empowering them to develop the skills they need to become active, vibrant adults? And what about taking money set aside for special programs to deal with mental health and teach these basic helping skills to all of the key stakeholders on a school campus, from bus drivers to custodians to coaches, deans, secretaries, counselors, lunch ladies? I have to tell you that not that this relates at all to the school attacks that we're talking about, the school shootings, but for my oldest daughter, going into junior high, struggling finding her way, trying to find her friend group, she was befriended by the lady who sold snack at the lunch cart every day and would chat with her. And she gave my daughter the job of selling snack every day at break. And this job, of course, put her in touch with all the other students on campus because they would come buy a snack. And it helped her to kind of find her place on campus and really feel connected. And for my other daughter in elementary school, who is kind of also finding her way, because all students are trying to find their way. Very few of them land on campus with a friend group that sticks. And when she was going through her struggle trying to find her way, she was befriended by Louie, the janitor at Ocean View School. Louie befriended, I don't know how many generations of students over the years, but he befriended my daughter, and she would go pick up trash with Louie during break, and they would chat, and it gave her a sense of belonging on campus that was important to her. And so those are small examples. But what about for the kids who have lost parents, or parents are going through the divorce, or are struggling with loss of an emotional relationship? You know, how do we deal with this going forward? 805-781-3875 is the number to be part of the conversation. All right, Patrick, what do you think? You're on the air.
are struggling with loss of emotional relationships.
Patrick, I'm having a hard time hearing you.
805-71. Oh,
Patrick, you need to either turn off your phone and give me a call back. I think I was only hearing myself coming back. So we'll give it another shot. 805-781-3875 is the number. So am I the only one who thinks about these things? I mean, think about the repercussions of voting if all of a sudden we bring in an entire new generation of young people to have the sense of empowerment to go to the polls and also to be educated. Because I don't know about you, but when I get the voting packet for the state of California, it's overwhelming. And how many of you really read everything about the initiatives or about every judge or about every, you know, thing? To have the education of how to kind of pour through and decipher what's being asked of us to vote on so that we can make responsible voting decisions are key. All right, let's give another shot here. Patrick, you're on the air. What's on your mind? Hi, Patrick. I don't know if he can hear me again. Patrick? Patrick, are you there?
Yes, ma'am, I am.
Hi, there we go. Tell me what's on your mind.
Well, first off, I'll let you know I'm a first-time caller of anything.
Oh, great. I inspired you. Before,
so, you know, if I fumble about, you know, pardon me.
That's okay.
But, first off, I just want to let you know I'm glad to be myself a survivor. And just a little bit about me, you know, I grew up in an alcoholic home. Both parents was violent. I was molested by a neighborhood pedophile at 10, and I think that was 10. Between 10 and 11 was my first suicide attempt. 14 was another one. And I was in and out of institutions because I was considered incorrigible is what they used, mm-hmm. the word. But it was no crime, but they put me in juvenile hall. At 17, I joined the military, and I came out a killer, man. And I was in and out of institutions because I was considered incorrigible is what they used, the word.
Patrick?
Hello?
Hi, I think I lost Patrick again, so... Patrick, call in one more time. I'm really sorry. 805-781-3875, because I really want to share your story, and I want to hear where you're going with this, because when the term incorrigible is a term used quite often that tells a student right away that they've thrown up their hands and given up on you, and I'm curious to know how it went for you in the military. So, Patrick, please give me a call back, 805-781-3875, because here we go. Patrick, are you there?
Yeah, yeah.
All right, today's not my phone day.
It was not really conducive for me as far as I was already an angry person.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was introduced to a lot of violence there. I'm not going to go into details, but it was not pleasant. Even when I got stationed over in Korea, there was a lot of racism. There was a lot of stuff going on that, you know, I was not into at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it was just very uncomfortable. And, you know, of course, I grew up in a society where I was not allowed to express myself,
mm-hmm.
period. You know, being told things like, you know, don't cry, I'll give you something to cry about. You know, just crazy, crazy behavior, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I don't even know how I survived, to be honest. I became a pretty good fighter. I know that, but people were afraid of me. I wasn't a big person, but nobody ever came back to fight me a second time because I usually hurt people, and that's what I did, and I did it without conscience. It's like, didn't matter. That was normal. That was normal. In fact, you know, if they didn't get up, it wouldn't have bothered me a bit, you know. But the reason why that I'm calling, I love your ideas, and I know mental health is probably the main thing we need to address in this country, because people are walking around, don't even know they're sick,
mm-hmm.
you know, or in slight denial of it because, you know, they don't want to express themselves because of the stigmas attached to it. So people don't seek help.
True.
And there's that also that people can't get over themselves. They feel holier than now or, you know, self-righteous, like they would not do that. You know, they wouldn't go there. You know, I'll tell you what, man, you don't know where you'll go until you're put behind the gun, you know, or put in a situation where your life's threatened or somebody else's life's threatened that you love. And, you just don't know what you're going to do, period. But to act out, you know, there's been many times I've had thoughts of, you know, harming others and in masses, you know, while I was in that stage, you know, because I felt like I was being victimized mm-hmm. over and over and over again.
Right. So, Patrick?
Fortunately, there was some divine intervention with me. And in 2004, I was got a call from a friend who was a Vietnam vet out in Wyoming. He just said, "What are you up to?" And I said, "Well, I'm trying to decide whether to put the bullet in my heart or in my head." Mm-hmm. And he asked me to come out there. I did. And when I got out there, he was more depressed than I was. And somehow it just flipped. And I found myself helping him. And when I came back to California, I won't go into details, but I kind of had a spiritual awakening at that point, and I just started seeking a spiritual path, and everything fell into place for me. I'd met a woman who helped me with that, and, you know, I can't tell you the kind of life I have today is beautiful compared to what I'd grown up with up until 2004. And I work as a peer support specialist now, and I was working with people with independent living who have mental health issues.
So you've turned it around.
And you're right. I think people need to be trained to identify that, because everybody has a story. You know, you're not just looking at a kid. You're looking at a kid with a whole life behind them.
Right. Or a story at home that they don't know how to process or what to do, what's happening at home. And in some ways, you kind of made my story for me, Patrick, because it was one person recognizing that you needed help and reaching out to you. And then another woman reaching out that recognized it, that made a difference. That's kind of the point of what I'm saying today, is if we put all of our energy towards one-on-one skills to reach out, that's that one-on-one connection that helps turn the corner for people, you know, that being seen and being witnessed, because all of the trauma that you experienced in grief as a child was only going to be healed if one other person saw you as a human and touched you touched your heart in a healthy, supportive way.
Well, yeah, I think what happened for me is, first off, what happened is, you know, I felt like my life did have some value, you know, that it wasn't, you know, a pile of crap.
Exactly.
That I could be helpful to somebody else. And believe me, my adult life after, you know, I got over the military. It took me a few years to get over that training and that, to be honest, is brainwashing. Mm-hmm. And I started reading self-help books. You know, I tried going back to church. And then I even thought, I even went into another branch of church. I became a Christian and belonged to this church for 4 years, and I just felt like I never fit in. And then this is not a put down on any church or any, you know, if that works for people, great. It didn't work for me in my case. And, you know, I had to go deeper and deeper until I found what I was looking for.
And Patrick, I'm sorry to jump in, because I want to make sure I give other callers a chance. That another point that you're making that I so appreciate is that there's also not an easy fix. That we hope with mental health that we're going to find one person, they're going to notice us and make it all better. And it's not just a one person. It may not be the person right next to you. It takes a lot of efforts. That helping someone heal psychically, healing wounds, overcoming trauma, feeling grief and living with grief, those are year-long processes. If you spend 10 years of your childhood or 15 years of your childhood being abused or neglected or overwhelmed or traumatized, it's going to take a good 10 or 15 years into your adulthood to find your footing. Then nothing happens overnight. That's why the world of medication seems so enticing, because it promises a quick fix. And so somehow we have to find the dance of the stabilizing of the emotions, but the long-term healing that goes with it. Patrick, thank you for taking the time to call. Lou, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Oh, yes, thank you. Well, first of all, I agree with you about lowering the age to 16 and definitely teaching voting skills and, you know, civic duty, vitally important. I know so many women, young women, who think voting and politics is just, oh, it's ugly, or, you know, they don't realize how much it impacts their lives and their, you know, if they have families, they just think it's some dirty business that they don't want anything to do with. And so if we make it something that's empowering and I always think we should make voting day like a big party day, you
agreed.
Know, street fairs and so on. But and also I think that as far as in the schools, meditation and breathing exercises, they've been doing some of that they seem to have success with. But also, I did want to say, and even just basic psychology, because I came from a very dysfunctional family, as so many people do, and you think you're the only one, mm-hmm. and everybody else is, you know, happy and doing fine, and you don't realize that things that you're struggling with, many people are struggling with. Mm-hmm. And so you can have a certain safety in knowing that there's other people, too. And then the final thing was, I was extremely shy, but in my junior year of high school, I had a social studies teacher who decided to just, you know, every day open the paper and see what the issues were and then leave it to us to, you know, split up, you know, split the room in half and have a debate about it. And I found my voice through that. I found that that was something that I really excelled at, even though in social situations I was very shy. And so years later, I went up to him to thank him because he was also a very awkward person himself, and he was just stunned to hear that he had had that much effect on somebody. So that's basically all I wanted to say, and thank you so much for the topic today.
Thank you, Lou, and thank you for calling in. And I think there's a lot of teachers out there who have no idea the impact they're having every day by something that they said to a student or taking an interest or noticing a student, that those are the things that can help turn the corners for individuals. 805-781-3875 is our number. And Kelly, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm calling because I have a question of your opinion.
Okay.
I work in a preschool setting in Chicago, and I have experienced over the last couple of years that at least once a year, one of my little three-year-olds will come into class and let us know, let her teachers know that their dad or their mom was killed in gun violence and that they witnessed it. And it's a thing that is we talk about high schoolers and middle schoolers a lot, but these kids are 3 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering what you think would be a necessary or appropriate or even worthwhile effort for starting these mental health and coping strategies for 3 year olds, 4 year olds, and 5 year olds, because they're exposed to this from such a young age and it's not going away for them.
What is the policy of the school? I'm just curious, what do they tell you? How do they instruct you to handle these things?
So in my position, I'm an assistant teacher, so I don't have the full records of the students. But over the year, we do get to know their families pretty well, and we're often probably told more than we're supposed to. Mm-hmm. So in terms of coping, we're told to not talk about it that much. If the student wants to bring it up, we allow them to bring it up. I'm wondering, not as much for me and what I can do, but sort of what schools can be doing, or if there is a way to start helping these students from an even younger age than middle school and high school. Is there anything that would be effective for preschoolers who are coping with gun violence and gang violence in urban areas? Because to me, I think that's probably where it starts, when they're exposed from that young of an age, losing parents or family members from that kind of violence.
Well, it sets up the pattern of trauma for these children and grief that needs to be nurtured and dealt with. You know, the kind of ignoring it and hoping it goes away part doesn't, but the actual talking about the experience and being able to grow strength and resilience from it. And here's an interesting statistic that I'm not sure what to do with it, but it's an interesting statistic, is that they found that children of color, of minority groups, tend to be exposed to violence more than white children. Would you agree?
Yeah.
I mean, that's statistically true.
Definitely.
And interestingly enough, as they grow into adulthood, they tend to have more resilience and better mental health than children from other communities who aren't raised in more violence or, you know, have to develop the resilience because they've been exposed to violence or trauma of some kind. So it's a strange kind of unwelcome statistic, but that somehow our mental health is not fragile. It's not fragile. You know, it can be fragile if it's unnurtured, but we have the capacity to be resilient, and not that we can get over the loss of a parent or get over, you know, witnessing gun violence and as if it never happened, but we have the capacity to absorb a lot of horrific experiences and develop a strength to carry on and develop a healthy worldview. And so to not see these children as victims, but to see them as resilient and strong and capable, and to put the focus and energy into building the resilience and strength in these children, that is the best help, because they're going to need the tools and belief in themselves moving forward when they hit those psychic roadblocks, right? Because having witnesses as a child, it's going to come up for them at strange times throughout their lives. Things will trigger that. And so really it's about building their inner resilience and their coping skills and their communication skills and their empathy skills, and treat them as strong, whole individuals. That's the key. And it's great that they don't share a lot of information about each student with you, because it would lend itself to victimizing or seeing these children as kind of, right?
Right.
So that would be my hope for the schools and for all schools, not just the inner city schools, but for all schools, is to see each child as a competent, capable individual. So we're not using terms like incorrigible or disciplinary problems or labels.
I think I worry about the risk of desensitizing them, about them being taught that this is a normal thing for them to go through death and loss, and that gun violence and gang violence is to be expected. So I think it's definitely interesting walking the line between desensitizing them, but also teaching them that they are strong and they can handle this and they are capable.
I know. And unfortunately, I don't know about the desensitizing part, because then let's talk about video games. And there's so many ways that we become desensitized to the actual act of living. But I think the other piece too, having an adult outside of school or in their lives that can help make sense of their life, to create a coherent narrative, like a story of their life that makes sense and is whole, will also help moving forward. The way to not have them be desensitized, but to have them write a different story, that I'm not just the kid whose dad was shot, or I'm not just the kid who grew up in inner city violence, but I am, you know, also from a family that goes to church on Sundays and loves to have family dinner, like to start rewriting that story too.
Of course.
All right.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for your great call. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. And you can be part of the conversation. It's 805-781-3875. You can also find me on my Facebook page, Elizabeth. Facebook page is The Reluctant Therapist, or send me an email to Elizabeth@TheReluctantTherapist.com. And you can podcast the show by visiting Apple Podcasts or NPR One and searching for A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And the conversation today really centers around kind of these two things that I feel are bubbling around the fringes of our March for Our Lives, and the efforts of people all over the country to stand up and say enough with the guns. We need regulations. We need some sort of change. We need to shift the culture in profound ways. But we can't just throw out, and we need to do better with mental health. We need to have some sort of plan. And it doesn't have to be this daunting, overwhelming plan. You know, mental health people are resilient. We have the capacity to heal. And if our schools and our neighborhoods and our communities focused on connection and communication skills. And I'm gonna take it even a wider berth from this, because I mentioned at the top of the show this idea that public education originally was created, one, to create an educated workforce so that we could become the domineering industrialized power in the world, but it was also to create a whole citizen, to help people understand the complexities of what it is to be an adult and to participate in a social world, in a civilized setting. And part of this also was focused on family life. You know, there's a lot of mixed feelings about this idea of home economics and it being taught in schools, and somehow, you know, gender specified that women would stay home and take care of children and men would go to work. But the part of home economics that was incredibly important was that it tasked the family with paying attention to the emotional well-being of the family. And if you listen to my introduction at the top of the show, I identify myself as an emotion worker, because when it comes to running a family, there's the emotion work and the resource work. And the resource work is how we bring home the bacon to feed everyone. But the emotion work is how we tend to the emotional well-being of the family. How do we nurture and show empathy and love and teach communication skills and feelings and warmth and create an environment that feels safe and loving and nurturing? That's the emotion work. And I don't care who does it, but it needs to be done in the family. And it needs to be as much a part of the family focus as the resource work. And without that emotion work being done, then you have people feeling listless and lost and depressed and anxious. And so this emotion work can be part of the school day, teaching people the very basic skills of witnessing and being with and hearing someone else. It doesn't mean you have to take them on. It doesn't mean you have to fix them. So often people are so afraid to hear someone else's story because they feel like, I don't have the answers. I don't know how to fix them. I don't know what to say. But believe me, here's the key to a therapist's life. We're not here to fix anybody. We're not here to give advice. We're not here to be the wise elder of all answers. We are here to listen and reflect and respond with care and love to help an individual make sense of their life as they know it and to rewrite the story of their life if the story they are living is not supporting them in the moment. And these are human skills. And so if we don't pay attention to the emotion work, and we only pay attention to the resource work, we launch children into the world with only one skill set, and that's how to be a consumer and how to make money. We should be spending as much time educating our young people on how to develop intimate, close, tied relationships. And so that means changing the narrative of our culture from a culture of being taught to work so that you live to work, to a culture that is about living and that work supports your life. Because somehow we changed that narrative from being work being the thing that supports the life that we care about, the people we care about, the world that we're in, the things we enjoy. We switched from being a world that worked to support our day-to-day to a world that lives to work. So I hope you'll take this conversation to your next dinner party or to your next activity and continue the conversation with us next Tuesday at 2. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This has been a conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. I appreciate your support, and I look forward to speaking with you next Tuesday. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. And Tyler, I'm going to help you work through that. I think it's cut number 4. We're going to leave you a little Neil Diamond because I like an anthem song to finish out my day whenever possible. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Holy, holy, dream of only me. Where
Touch a man who can't walk on.